This is United Tribes News Radio. Insights into Native culture, people, ideas, topics to improve understanding from United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. Democracy relies on dialogue, talk, discussion, and give and take. But what happens when communicating with one another is corroded by opinions, misinformation, accusations, and assertions? How can discussion flourish when assumptions abound, positions are polarized, and minds are closed? How do we exercise democracy when we can't seem to talk to each other? In this edition of United Tribes News Radio, the subject is having community conversations. Our guides on the subject are two experts who make it their work to teach and train organizations to have conversations that matter.
My name is Jerry Nagel. I currently live in Minnesota, about 45 miles east of Fargo, out in the countryside. But I grew up here in Bismarck. I'm a graduate of Bismarck High School, and I'll date myself by saying I'm a graduate of Bismarck Junior College also. Then I have a master's degree from the University of North Dakota and a PhD from Tilburg University in the Netherlands. What brought me here today for this work is two things. One is I'm a steward in the global community of the art of hosting conversations that matter, and so a substantial part of my work for the past several years has been in training people in how to be in good conversations, particularly groups of people in good conversations. And as part of my PhD dissertation work, we developed a program out of that called Worldview Intelligence, which is a structured way for people to begin to explore worldviews, whether personal or organizational, professional, cultural. And so that's now a substantial part of my work and the work that I do with my colleague, Kathy Jourdain, and was a big part of the work that we did here these past 2 days.
My name is Kathy Jourdain, and I'm Canadian. I grew up in Nova Scotia, and I've lived there all my life. I still live there. I've been doing consulting work for a couple of decades now, and like Jerry, I'm a global steward in the art of hosting conversations that matter, which is really about tapping into the collective intelligence that exists in any group, and co-founder of this worldview intelligence work that Jerry and I have been developing over the last 4 or 5 years, and that we've had the opportunity to bring to a variety of places in a number of different countries, including the U.S., Canada, Australia, Germany, and France, to name a few. And really excited to have been here at the United Tribes Technical College, bringing this work to the people here in support of conversations that are coming up in the community.
Let's explore this term worldview intelligence a little bit and give us an explanation of what that is, how that term applies to this work that you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, we think of worldview intelligence in a broader sense of building the skills to be self-aware around one's own worldview, and the skills to explore and be in good conversation with people with similar or differing worldviews, particularly in situations where there might be differing worldviews, but you need to work on something together, something that matters. So there is, initially we sort of talked about worldview awareness, but that is really sort of an awareness of one's own worldview or that worldviews exist, whereas worldview intelligence is a more comprehensive program that really dives much more deeply into the skills of self-understanding and working with others with similar or differing worldviews.
If I would just step it back a pace to answer the question of what is a worldview. A worldview is really, most simply, it's the way that we see the world and the way that we interact with the world, but it's mostly held in our unconscious and we're not aware of the lenses through which we see the world. And so our worldview operates mostly invisibly, but it impacts our relationships, our communication, any tensions that might show up in our families, in our workplace, or in our communities. And by becoming aware of what our worldview might be, that can help us think about how we want to be in relationship and communication differently.
Are we all aware of what our world view is? Is there a majority of people who are aware of their world view, do you find in your work?
I would say that most people don't have an awareness of worldview. When we started to bring the idea of worldview into the work that we were doing, building on Jerry's dissertation and his research, we would ask people, what is your worldview and how do you know? And people would go, whoa, I don't know. I never thought of that question before. And the even with a very jarring question like, what is your worldview and how do you know, we began to notice that people were in some very different conversations because they were self-reflective first, and then being curious about my own worldview made me more curious about somebody else's worldview, how they came to see the world, and that took us to this place of there must be a gentler way into the conversation, which took us back to Jerry's research and his dissertation.
Tell us about that research.
Great, thank you. So I set out several years ago to actually explore what would be an art of hosting worldview, and I wanted to do it in a way where we could begin to either say there's elements of it that are clear and elements that aren't, and needed a structure for that work, and looked, did as often in a dissertation work, a broad lit search around seeing if there are ways to, in our language, deconstruct a worldview, begin to take this big word and explore it in a more structured way. And what I found was that in what we might call modern literature, which would be the past couple hundred years, most of the thinking around worldviews took place either in Christian theological literature, in scientific literature, or philosophical literature. And I should note that this is English language literature, unless I ran across something that was translated from another language. And one of the things that was really important to me was that it be relatively neutral. So there's a lot of great writing and great authors in Christian literature, but it all assumed a belief in a God, and in a particularly a Christian God. And there's pretty good work in the scientific world, but you know, it assumed a view from the as a chemist or a physicist or a biologist, so it wasn't neutral. And so I came across the work of a philosopher from Belgium, Leo Apostel. Apostel was of the perspective that our world was becoming increasingly fragmented, and was there a way that we could create an approach to addressing this fragmentation through looking at worldviews? So if you and I have different worldviews and that was causing us not to be able to communicate well, could we find an approach that would create an ability for us to communicate? And he assembled a group of thinkers from around the world, philosophers, scientists, cyberneticists, theologians, sociologists. They became known as the Worldviews Group. And they came up with a framework that could be used, that was neutral and could be used across disciplines to begin to, as I just said, deconstruct a worldview. And that framework has six dimensions to it. It was a very philosophical piece of work, I took that work in my dissertation and translated it into sort of everyday language that we could work with, and we then took that translation of this deeply philosophical piece into a practical language and have turned it into a learning program and into a way for people to be in the exploration we're in now. So the framework we use has substantial academic research behind it, but it's now really used in a very practical way.
Let's find out about that, the practical side of this. What are the practical uses that you've been putting to this? You have been busy people working with groups all around the country, all around the world, and what has it led to?
So one of the driving forces behind the worldview work is this idea of fragmentation and increasingly polarization. And people have this curiosity about how to be in conversation with people who might have a very different worldview. So on one level, this can happen on the global the global level, but it can also happen organizationally around social systems within professions. And inside of organizations, it could be as simple as one department has a very different worldview than another department, and they don't know how to talk to each other. And so being able to look at elements of those worldviews enables them to be in a different conversation with each other. So that's one fairly simple application. We've also been asked to come in and support innovative projects or initiatives inside of organizations. So one piece of work that we're doing is with the Nova Scotia Barristers Society in Nova Scotia, where I live, and they are right now changing the way they regulate the profession of law. Their work is very innovative. It is leading edge around the world, and they saw a use of worldview intelligence to support their work, since it requires people to think very differently about their interactions for the staff with lawyers or legal entities, and also with the public and even for themselves. And in the U.S., we're working with a healthcare company that has a new innovative approach to clinics and their interaction with patients. And we were also asked to come in and provide a worldview intelligence program for them to think about how they're doing their work, which looks at each of the clinics, the similarities across the clinics, but also the differences, and then how they can learn from each other as they think about those differences.
In the instance that's brought you to Bismarck, mm-hmm. to work with United Tribes and some other groups in the communities here, it's a matter of community friction, it might be called at this point, that has occurred because of certain political and or tribal matters that have entered upon the consciousness of Bismarck and Mandan and the world, in fact, over the year 2016. So you work with a wide variety of groups, with business, with industry, and with community groups. And what's the construct of how you go about working with them then, how you apply these principles of worldview?
Well, so first, it's really specific to the invitation of the organization or company that we work with. So if it's a 200,000 member union that wants to sort of reinvent itself, how we might approach that would be different than a healthcare company with 30,000 employees, or I'm about to design I am designing a project for a holding company in another country that wants to develop a new value statement that approaches. So each of these have some uniqueness to them. And so in the case of the labor union, they want to switch from a service model to an organizing model, and they want to bring along all of the reps and the negotiating and field reps and so on. And so there is a real process of, okay, where have we been? How did we get there? Which is a bit of a history part of worldviews. And where do we want to go to? Which is a bit of the future element of worldviews. What's our reality we deal with on a daily basis as we're out there dealing with school districts or school boards? And how are they going to respond to, this new approach we're bringing? And then we begin to think about, well, what are our practices as organizers? What needs to change? And so what happens is we can take each of these six dimensions and look at them from the lens of what's been, what is, and what could be, and that sort of becomes the working construct. And we have hundreds of questions that invite people into the exploration. So it's not just, it is really quite structured in many ways, and yet holds for the adaptability to each circumstance that we deal with. Whether in other places, we just had a colleague in Europe submit a proposal to the Model UN, and they were very intrigued. We've done a lot of work with foundations around the country, and each one is sort of unique in their own way, and yet the framework is adaptable to their specific context.
And if I was to speak more specifically to your question of how we ended up here in Bismarck in this time, there with Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline and a variety of other political issues that are showing up on the radar, as you said, not just here, but when we were in Europe, we were getting questions about what was happening over here. What we know is that there are a variety of views attached to each of these issues, and that many people hold these views very strongly. And when we hold views very strongly, then it's really hard to be in an exploration or an exploratory conversation that opens up possibilities or helps us begin to understand each other. And so part of the work of worldview is to help people understand what happens when we become very attached to our view, how much harder it is to be open-minded when we're attached to a point of view, and then what are some entry points into a conversation that begins to open that up so that even if I don't agree with your view, I can still have a conversation with you that helps us begin to see more of the picture than the slice of it that I'm really attached to.
Some people refer to this as polarization. Mm-hmm. And the characteristics of it are delimiting to any kind of conversation mm-hmm. at all. And these are the kind of circumstances that you run into, that people have called you in on, these hot spots. And how do you begin then this process of deconstructing these things and getting the conversation going, getting people to talk?
I think the first part of it is often this part of self-awareness. So what is my worldview? What happens when my worldview is threatened? There's a lot of research out there that says our worldview is very closely related to our identity. And when you begin to threaten my worldview or the way I think, then it doesn't invite me into conversation, but it causes me to double down on the point of view that I already hold. When my worldview is threatened, then it's as if my very life is threatened. And so the first thing I want to do is defend. And the other thing that I might want to do is dismiss. And so helping people understand that this is a natural part of our identity and our worldview then enables us to press a pause button and go, oh, this is the kind of, I just went defensive, I just went reactive. So that's first part of it. The other part of it is this word worldview, we use it to describe the whole of a person. So someone is a water protector or a protester, depending on your point of view, at Standing Rock, and we make up a whole story about them based on this one slice. And again, part of the invitation around worldview is, how can I see the person who's standing in front of me and not just make a whole bunch of assumptions based on one action or one thought or one statement that they've made? And the more I can connect, first of all, to my own humanity, then the greater the possibility of connecting to the humanity in another person, and then the greater the possibility of moving into a different conversation.
Have you had success with it? How do you measure the successes you've had in these other settings where you've gone in and practiced worldview?
Well, essentially, we hear stories from people saying we're operating completely differently now. You know, we've gone into situations where staff were in turmoil, and after some work, you know, they're like, the whole thing has changed. People are working together. They're getting along. They're making progress. They understand each other. It doesn't mean that they all agree, but they know how to work together and attend to things. Or people have said, you know, we did some work with this healthcare company, and one of the leadership groups found out that all of the other teams didn't really think that they mattered very much. And so now they had to rethink how they interrelated with each other in a way that was more productive. And we heard from one of the people that is there, says, you can't believe how different the teams are operating now. They're just completely so much more innovative and productive, and they're supporting each other so much more. So we hear a lot of those kinds of things where just the whole internal dynamic changes. And that's really very reassuring. One other thing to build on what Kathy was sharing that we that's really helpful here is to, what we like to say is, we make visible the starting point that people come into a conversation. So for example, we're also doing some work in another state where there's some tension between a local community and a local tribal group. And they live side by side. They're even closer than Bismarck and Stanley, right? They're right next door. You move one, you win. And these tensions are longstanding. And so we've done some work there about, you know, what are the starting points? And one thing that was really interesting is the white community, was their starting point was very much when asked to talk about their community and what's best about their community from their worldview, it was very much, very economic. So all the things were celebrated was economic achievement in the community. When we asked the tribal community to what's best about their community, it was all about resilience, the well-being of the community, how we took care of each other, how we celebrated each other. So two starting points, one much more about the individual and one much more about the community. If you come into conversations and don't know that, there's going to be a clash. You know, those worldviews are going to collide. But if you know this is where we're coming from, okay, then how can we interact with each other in a different way that honors and recognizes each worldview but allows us to work together on something that matters?
One of the challenges around polarity is that it's either this or it's that. And what worldview does is it opens up many more possibilities between this or that and invites people to think more broadly about what some of the options might be. And there is something in the language of worldview that enables people to step back and depersonalize it. And it sounds really easy when I say it like that. And it actually is a practice for people, and it takes a lot of work, and it takes not just self-awareness, but it takes, I think, a community coming together to be willing to support each other in that exploration and not get trapped into the either or and only the rhetoric that we begin hearing from a side or another side, but to really get underneath of that to what's really important and what do we value. And so very often we'll talk about all the facts, but we know that facts can be interpreted. And when we want to get underneath of that, what people are really concerned about is the future. Or they're thinking about their family, or they're thinking about their livelihood. And it's not so much about this fact or that fact, but when we can connect on that level of what are we thinking about the future? What are our fears about the future? What are our hopes about the future? What do we really want for our families? Then that begins to shift and change the conversation.
What role does fear play on the part of groups that are engaged in these kinds of discussions? Where does that enter into either limiting people from becoming involved or bringing in baggage into these discussions?
It's a powerful element in human behavior and in group behavior. There's a real difference between anxiety, which is a perceived threat, and fear, which is a response to a real threat. And when we respond to a real threat, we respond with sort of that fight, flight, freeze syndrome. If we hold anxiety about something long enough, a perceived threat, and part of group behavior is we start to hang out with people that think like us. It's just natural, and we start to do reinforce each other's thinking about something, and some of that reinforcement becomes reinforcing anxiety. And so then the perceived threat eventually turns into, from anxiety to fear, and even though it's not a real threat, it becomes one to us. And so then we start to hold on to our beliefs about others as very strongly. We hold on, we become more prejudiced, we become more unaccepting of differing views. So that's one big element. Another sort of big element of around the fear piece is that the devil you know is far better than the prize. So people are more willing to hold on to something strongly, even though it might be not good for them, than they are to give it up for the promise of something they don't know, even though it might be offered to be better. So that sort of fear of change, that fear of letting go, is a real factor in here. We, that's It's why people stay oftentimes in bad situations, you know, in bad personal situations, even though there's a promise of something better.
The thinking a little bit about what expectations people could have coming into a setting such as the one that's offered to come up soon, sponsored by United Tribes. What would you say about what Bismarck and in this area and the tribes could achieve using this methodology?
Well, you never know for sure until you're in the situation. But I know a lot of what we talked about in the last couple of days is how can the team that is working on hosting these community conversations, how can they prepare themselves and the invitation and the space really well so that it feels welcoming. One of the things that we talk about is all views are important, and how do we get all of the views into the room? How do we encourage people and invite them to be able to speak what's true for them and what's on their mind so that people can begin to understand sort of more of I want to say the issue, but I don't really feel like that's the right thing, but how they can begin to see more of the complete picture so that there's a different view or an opening to, we talk about expanding our worldview. So how can I hear somebody else's worldview? How can I even recognize that somebody else might have a different worldview than me? Because one of the challenges we face when we're not aware of worldview is many people think we all have the same experience, we all see the world the same way. And the first time I'm confronted with that, the tendency is to want to say, well, no, that's not the way it is. And so part of what this team has been preparing to do is create the space so that people can share the way that they see the world. And if I begin to understand how you came to see the world the way you do, then that offers an opportunity for a different conversation than if I'm trying to convince you the way I see the world is the right way.
One of the things we know from our larger work, not just the worldview work, is if you begin a conversation with difference, you amplify the difference. So if you start from where we disagree, we amplify the disagreement. So part of the worldview work is to find where is the common ground that we might share. And so, you know, for somebody in this situation, you know, common ground might be, we really all want to have a healthy environment. I mean, does anybody want around saying they don't want one? So how do we get there? Our perspective on the journey might be different, but could we get there in a way that meets both needs? I did some work around water quality in southern Minnesota a while back, and one of the conversations that has stuck with me for a long time was between an environmentalist and a farmer. And the conversation was, what do you love about this river? And as they discovered that they both held a deep love about the river, then the question was, well, why is there this tension? And the environmentalist is like, you don't care, you know, I know you say you care about the river, but I don't see it in your actions. And the farmer says, I care about this river, but if you do what you propose, I fear for my livelihood. And so now the conversation could change from, how do we assure that the farmer can be a farmer and the river can be healthy? Instead of, you have to give something up, and I get to get something, and you lose something. And so you move out of the adversary into the possibility of accomplishing something that they both really care about in a way. And what can happen here is the beginnings to find out, where do we share some common ground, and how do we build from that as a community so that all of our children, whether native or non-native, have good education and have good food and good diet, and our economy thrives and stays alive as a community for everyone. And I think anybody walks around and says, I hope part of the people get to stay poor forever and businesses fail. And yet, when we only see a person one-dimensionally, then we start to put them in categories that don't serve the well-being of the community as a whole.
I think the other thing that happens is that sometimes with very strongly held worldviews, people will say, and this often happens in a dominant culture, people will say, come on over here. We got it all figured out. We know what to do. and we'll teach you. And the worldview work basically says there are pieces of answers all over the place, and what is the intersection of worldviews where we can all learn from each other? And that's where the new solutions or new ideas are going to arise.
People change when they go through this process if they're open to it and they participate openly and freely?
We often find that people's worldviews expand as they entertain the idea that there are very valid different perspectives out there. They don't have to agree with a different perspective necessarily, but even just acknowledging that it exists changes the nature of the conversation.
So we never come into this saying we're here to change your worldview. Because immediately it's like, well, that comes back to that my identity's threatened kind of thing. But we come into a conversation saying, how can you become more aware of what your worldview is? So if you're disagreeing with something, what's the source of that? Is this an issue about values? Is this a family life experience? Is it something else in your daily reality? So that awareness becomes really important, because then we can know where the conversation conflict might really be, or where the opportunity to move forward might really be. So it's important not to talk about, for us very much, that we're changing worldviews. That doesn't mean we have to be sympathetic or agree to another worldview, but we can begin to understand where someone comes from. I have a good friend that I've worked with for about 30 years, and our political views are substantially far apart. But there's an issue we really care about a lot, and that's the well-being of rural communities. And we've set all those other issues aside to focus on that. And both of us have learned a lot about how to find common ground. And I think his worldviews have expanded and shifted a little bit, you know, because he's seen opportunities in organic farming he hadn't seen before for rural communities. He's seen some opportunities in some other arenas in agriculture he hadn't seen before that could really benefit rural communities. And so instead of saying you got to change, let's see where we can work together and what can we learn in that expanded perspective.
So this is not one of those so-called zero-sum matters at all. Far from it.
Right. Yep, that's right. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about process here. You shared with us the World Cafe. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you would describe that, and for people who might be attending some of these sessions, they would be exposed to it too.
Mm. So the World Cafe is an engagement process that works on the assumption that if we bring people together and we offer them really good questions, then they can work out solutions or find points of connection that they might not otherwise find. And so we can take a lot of people and invite them into a room together, and every single person who comes has the opportunity to speak. And it's a big differentiator for me between a town hall experience where you have a panel of speakers and a mic in the center of the floor and you get five people who have the time to ask a question because all the panelists need to respond. This is a place where the facilitators, or in our language, hosts of the experience, provide a process with some good questions and then get out of the way and let people be in the conversations that most matter to them. And so in the process, you sit at a table with a small group of people. Everybody has a chance to introduce themselves and speak. There is a high likelihood you're going to meet someone that has a very different perspective than you do. You will meet people that you didn't know before you came into the space, and you'll be invited into a question, and we don't know what the questions are yet because they haven't been formulated. But after 20 minutes or so in a conversation at one table, there's an invitation for people to get up and move so that you now meet another table of people and you're invited into a second question, and that often happens a third time. And one of the things that we're looking for in that kind of process is, what are the themes and the patterns that people care most about? And as we ask people to share out from their conversations, we begin to discover what those themes and patterns are that are common across a whole room of people. And it can be quite a powerful experience for people as they realize this thing that was important to me that I brought to my table, three conversations down, I'm hearing it all the way across the room coming from somebody else. And so I might walk in with an idea that's important to me, but by the end of an evening, by the end of a couple of hours, we all collectively own the conversation that happened in that space.
So you think that the Bismarck audience with its collective wisdom can come together and will bring some thoughtful observations and solutions maybe to matters that have taken place here?
That would be the hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to just affirm something Kathy said and you asked in your question. Foundational to this whole notion of the art of hosting conversations that matter is that the wisdom to find the way forward exists within the room, within the people involved, within the community. It doesn't mean we don't at times bring in some expertise so we have information and knowledge, but we don't need an expert to tell us what to do. That if we create what to do from our own wisdom, then we own the solution. And when we own it, it belongs to us, we care about it, and we want it to succeed, as opposed to if Jerry walks in and gives a solution, it's just Jerry's solution. If it succeeds, fine, and if it doesn't, it's his fault, not mine, not our community's. And so whether it's World Cafe or Open Space or Responsive Planning Framework or any of the number of things we do in Art of Hosting, it's based on the assumption that if we release that wisdom in the room, we can find a way forward. It doesn't happen instantly all of the time. So one conversation doesn't mean that necessarily that we're going to have the way forward. But it begins to open maybe a little bit of the door, a little bit of the door, and next time, and next time, and next time. But part of the hope, I think, for the very first conversation is that we begin to experience what it's like to be in good conversation with each other that's not argumentative. That's not one position trying to convince another position, but how can we be in conversation where we can learn from each other and begin to create the possibilities to be in community, to be in relationship, and find solutions to the challenges that we're faced and that really matter to us. Another conversation might move that further and another conversation further. And pretty soon you start to build strategic plans and you start to build actions. We're on a project around addressing a workforce shortage, and that's about a 9-month project, with the business community, with the education community, and so on. How are we going to deal with this, that if we don't address the workforce shortage, our community is not going to have workers? So, yeah.
One of the things that occurs to me is the issues that are alive in this community, people care deeply about, and usually the only people we're talking to are other people who think like us. And one of the challenges in that is then we become more attached to that point of view, and it's harder for us to entertain a different thought or a different point of view. And I don't know how many opportunities there are for members of the community to come together in an environment where there may well be someone who's got a very different worldview or different perspective, and to engage in a respectful conversation about that so that I feel heard on my perspective, but I'm also listening to someone else's perspective, and we create that environment where it is okay for us to have different points of view, and maybe one or both of us move to some other point on where those views are. But I just think there's not that many opportunities to be engaged in passionate conversation about things that we care about in a healthy, constructive environment.
I'll share a little quick story, if you don't mind. So some of the folks here may remember, and you, I'm sure, do, Dennis, that about 4 years ago, Minnesota state government shut mm-hmm. down. The legislature and the governor couldn't come to agreement. So Foundation in Minnesota wanted to try an experiment. Could citizens solve the budget problem? And so we did sort of modified World Cafe in three communities in Minnesota. When people came in, the sort of the expertise piece was, this is how much money we have for revenue. This is how much money we have to spend. These are the big buckets, transportation, social services, education, and so on. So not the details of the education department. And in 90 minutes, in every community, they solved the problem. because no one had a vested interest to a particular political stance or a political view. They looked at what they had. We had people that were conservatives saying, well, one of our options is to raise some taxes. Maybe if we could do that, you know, because that was an option on the table if you wanted to go outside the bucket of available resources. And you know, some of it was, you know, these are population trends. This is what's going to happen here. And so given an opportunity to just be in an exploratory, creative conversation without necessarily a vested interest, people can do amazing things.
Mm-hmm. The concept of a safe environment to do this within, which you mentioned this before, elaborate on it just a little bit more, just to emphasize that anybody thinking about or being invited to this event will be coming there to be listened to and to with care and being invited.
We often talk about a safe enough environment, because if you make it completely safe, then nobody actually does talk about the things that are important to them. I think when we care deeply about something, sometimes it feels risky to say what we think, especially if we don't know how it's going to be received. And I think there are two things that will make this a safe enough environment. One is, I'll go back to the preparation that the team is doing to make this space welcoming and invitational. And everybody, hopefully, as they walk into that space, will feel that they are personally welcomed and invited to be there. So that's one. A second is, we have in the World Cafe process, we have what we call cafe etiquette, which is an invitation into that conversation, which is to, you know, bring your thoughts, bring your passion, but also be willing to listen to somebody else. We want people to contribute. We want them to pay attention to inviting other people to contribute at the table as well. And our experience is that when somebody risks saying what's true for them, and sometimes that makes them feel very vulnerable, it actually is an invitation for other people at the table to also do the same thing. So we do see that happening. The other component of it will be the questions that invite people into the conversation. And so that's a bit of it, but also it's the framing and the flow and the, not just the hello, how are you welcome, but the big welcome to everybody who shows up in that space and that invitation as well.
We are very fortunate, Kathy and I, to work with a broad range of extraordinary people from many different cultures and around the world. One person that we do a lot of work with is Lemoyne Lapointe. Lemoyne has become a dear friend. We're shared grandfathers, so we share stories together around all of that. And we like to say we're mentoring each other, that we're all learning from each other. So it's that kind of lovely collaborative learning relationship. Lemoyne is an elder from Rosebud. He lives in the Twin Cities now. We met him several years ago and started working with him and worked with him a lot in many different places. He brings his Lakota wisdom and history and perspective. And so what we have is differing worldviews. And those differing worldviews and sometimes similar life experiences and sometimes not. One of the things about Lemoyne is we found that we've been in a lot of the places at the same time and our paths didn't cross. You know, when I worked for Governor Link and we had some issues down at Standing Rock, Lemoyne and I were both down there, and other times. But he's skilled in all of the art of hosting practices and works of, and he in particular does a lot of work with youth. That's his passion. He's very involved with youth indigenous populations around the world, does a lot of work for the United Nations, and he brings a wisdom and a humility, the care and heart that you want to be in the space. Some folks have talked about what's happening down in Rapid City, and Lemoyne is a critical player in the conversations that are working to shift things in Rapid City.
He's a masterful storyteller. And uses the stories to create openings for conversations and responses to questions. And it's a deeply respectful, mutual relationship where I think he's able to integrate his traditional way of thinking and knowing with a lot of the less traditional processes and methodologies that we bring, and so it works really well. He's gracious as well as humble.
Well, we're very appreciative that the two of you came here, that we had a chance to go through some many hours of sharing and learning from you, and we're very hopeful that this initiative is going to work out to contribute to Bismarck, Mandan, and Standing Rock, and to the area and the region as a whole. I'll turn the tables on you and do what you do to your groups here. Any closing thoughts, any last thoughts from you?
So one of my closing thoughts would be just gratitude for having been invited here to do the work with United Tribes Technical College and the North Dakota State University people who showed up. And one of the enduring thoughts that came out over these day and a half, one is the people who are here are passionate. They really care about these issues. They really want to make a difference. They want to be able to respond to community requests. And the number of times the word hopeful came up, as in I'm feeling hopeful, I'm feeling excited, was very heartwarming and really will contribute to how the team that's working on these community conversations will carry them forward.
In the one last little thing I would say in addition to what Kathy shared as a reflection is just to give a bow of respect to the courage that I think is here at United Tribes Technical College to step into the work that is important for the community, important for the college, and it's a privilege to be a small part of it.
Jerry Nagel and Kathy Jourdain were two of the trainers during a Worldview Intelligence workshop at United Tribes Technical College. They were interviewed by Dennis Newman. Learn more at worldviewintelligence.com. This program was produced by United Tribes Technical College, Office of Public Information. Dennis Newman, Director. Alicia Heglin-Thorpe, Producer. This series is designed not only to strengthen our communities, but to give insight and understanding of a tribal culture and a Native people. For more information, visit our website, UTTC.edu.